Just a little housekeeping from yesterday. It is fad and not fade. Now, I found different people reacting differently to that. One person, after my class was over, got to me in 2.1756 seconds and explained to me that that was wrong. 38 of you noticed it was wrong, just weren't fast enough to get to me. The most impressive group are the 6 of you who thought that it was a French word, fade. There were 157 of you who are just as bad at it as I am, and you're clueless. And the last group are the 17 of you who were asleep and have no idea what I'm talking about. Well, 18 counting Wade. I'm going to look at a passage in Genesis 4 and one in Romans 1. I don't know if we should read these as a round or not, but we probably won't. We'll begin with Genesis chapter 4. Need to get my head back in the game now, which is no small task. John Woody actually was the one who got to me in 2.175 seconds. For 3 years, he has been my proofreader, and we have debated my and his accuracy, and it's been a tie until yesterday, and I had to give him that one. I want to begin in Genesis chapter 4 because I think that is where we see really the first manifestation of a culture and a society, as at least I understand a good definition. In the first part of Genesis chapter 4, we have the obvious sin of Cain and Abel. I think even the children are familiar with that. In verse 16 and following through the rest of that chapter, we have what I would call the development of the first two societies or cultures. MacArthur, in his dealing with this particular passage, I thought made a good point. In God's eyes, there are only two cultures and two societies. There's a secular culture and there's a sacred culture. As we use those terms today, there are different countries have different cultures. I want to make just a couple of summary comments on these last few verses and then maybe go back and deal with them in just a little bit more detail. But there are several things that really interest me there. And I'm going to read a few of the verses. And I know some of those names, we don't really know how to pronounce them. So I'll pronounce them my way and you read them your way. Verse 16 of Genesis chapter 4. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Canaan. And Cain knew his wife, and she conceived and bare Enoch, and he builded a city and called the name of the city after the name of the son of his son Enoch. And unto Enoch was born Irad, and Irad begat Mahujael, and Mahujael begat Methusael, and Methusael begat Lamech, and Lamech took unto him two wives. The name of one was Ada, and the name of the other was Zillah. And it goes on down and discusses this. You'll notice in verse 23, Lamech has a discussion with his wives. He had apparently had to kill somebody, possibly in self-defense, but yet he had some sense of right and wrong because he remembered the trepidation that Cain had gotten into and is seemingly asking for some mercy. But as we go down through these verses in a cultural or societal sense, if you notice in verse 17, we have a city built. Cain, and he named it after his son Enoch. We've got urbanization beginning in Genesis chapter 4, verse 17. A business society is being developed. It's also interesting to note that from verses 17 to 24, there is no mention of God at all. The only mention of God that we really have in the verses that I'm looking at is verse 16, And it says, Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. And some would describe that to be the first great division within cultures and society. From verse 16 on, you have those who were in the presence of the Lord, apparently, and those who had opted to leave the presence of the Lord. And I don't take that in a geographical sense. I take it in a spiritual sense. You might note in verse 19, we have polygamy being introduced, which I guess we could say God in His mercy allowed it, but I think we can also say God in His wisdom never wanted it. In verse 20, we also know that there is livestock and property. There was prosperity within the secular society of Cain. Verse 21, there was musical instruments. Verse 22, there seems to have been some capacity for metallurgy and working with metals. Those 3 points, I think, are an indication that Cain's secular society was somewhat blessed by the Lord. We'll talk about it a little bit more in a few moments, but that's what I would call, and many would call, common grace. Even sinners receive some grace from God. They don't receive salvational grace until they accept the Lord. But they get the sunlight, they get the rain, they're able to have families, they're able to have food. That's common grace that God has given to us all. And it appears that Cain's society or lineage, if we shall say, had that common grace. We see violence being certainly introduced by the time we get to verses 23 and 24, where Lamech had this trepidation with whomever he had the conflict with. I believe Genesis chapter 4, with Cain and Abel, and then with these two societies that we're going to see developed, are really somewhat the beginnings of conflict within societies and cultures. And when you think about it, really everything that we've talked about in my session this week, it's really a conflict between the sacred culture and the secular culture. Monday after my class, somebody came up and made a comment, and I didn't write it down, so I'll have to try to paraphrase it. If we didn't have a Christian biblical worldview, we wouldn't worry about any of these things. And I think that's absolutely right. I worry about my children. I worry about you. You worry about me from a moral, spiritual standpoint because of our Christian worldview. If we didn't have that worldview, it really wouldn't matter that much. Maybe we'd still be against murder, but we'd have a hard time intellectually explaining why we were against it. We just don't like it. But here's the conflict. If you notice down then in verse 25 and 26, and then the fifth chapter, I'm not going to read all of that. When he gets to verse 25, he jumps back to Adam, and we pick up the other son, Seth. Seth, who then bore a son, called his name Enos. And notice in the last, probably the last phrase of chapter 4, then began men to call upon the name of the Lord. Probably our first official reference to worship. Now, I would say that Abel's offering was worship, and I'm not saying this is the first act of worship, but this is a seminal point in the development of man's culture. Men calling upon the name of the Lord. So I want to just think a little bit about these passages and about these two cultures, and then we'll move on then to maybe Romans chapter 1 as it appears to be. I think it is important, however, for us to understand that the secular culture, which I'm calling Cain's lineage, was not devoid of any blessing, of all blessings from God. The difference was, it appears to me, the blessings that came to Cain were of a temporal nature, and at least to some extent, the blessings that came to Seth's lineage were of a spiritual nature. I see no evidence that any of Cain's descendants were godly. If they were, I don't know about it. It's not really referenced there. And we will have to admit most of Seth's descendants were not godly, probably, because some 1,600 years later, we've got the flood, and at a maximum, we've got 8. I'm not sure we've even got 8. We may only have 1. Noah was righteous. His family may have been righteous, or they may have gotten along on his coattails. I just don't know. I like to think there were 8. But even if there were eight, most of Seth's lineage was probably not godly. But out of Seth's lineage came people like Enoch, who was taken up in the rapture. And, of course, out of Seth's lineage came Noah, that we're all quite familiar with, who was Enoch's great-grandson. Out of Seth's lineage comes Methuselah, whose really claim to fame is that he's listed with the oldest age in the Bible. I don't know if Methuselah was the oldest man to ever live, but he's the oldest age that's recorded. So we remember him. And he probably died in the year of the flood. But what really began to separate these two cultures is that the sacred culture is governed today by a book, and it's called the Bible. And that's what I think most, if not all of us, try to guide our lives by. For the family of Satan, this book is a big problem, because the Bible lies at the root of cultural conflict. It is because of biblical teachings that we have conflict. It's why you and I can't be pluralistic, because we believe there is a right and a wrong. Now, the family of Satan, or the culture of Cain, however we want to term it, is perfectly happy and content for us to have our Bible, to study it, to read it, and to talk about it, as long as we do it in private. That's the real burning issue. I don't know anybody that opposes people reading their Bibles. It's when it is in a public forum that it becomes a conflict. And we see that in some of our legislation, and we see it in various aspects of our daily lives. But men did, very early, begin to call upon the name of the Lord, and we were therefore introduced to worship. I don't know what percentage of Seth's descendants were spiritual. I just know some of them were. All of us are Sethites. We all are. Because Cain's lineage was destroyed in the flood. And all the other lineages. Noah was a Sethite, so we're all Sethites. So we do owe a deal of gratitude to those men and women who were able to ascertain that. Now I'd like to look for just a moment to Romans chapter 1. You would have expected me, and probably some of the others as they might deal with this topic, to go there for some of the sins that we see today, and that will be appropriate. But I want to spend just a little bit of time on a progression, if you will, here in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 is one of the insights into when God gets completely fed up, for want of a better phrase. God is a patient God. He is an enduring God. But even God sometimes has to say, enough is enough. That's what he did at the flood. And that's what he's going to do again at the judgment day. But I don't know that I think that God is restricted to those two times when he said, enough is enough. Three times in this first chapter, verses 24, 26, and 28, the term gave them over is used. Look at verse 24. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts. Verse 26. For this cause God gave them up unto vile affections. And in verse 28. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind. Now we could spend the rest of my time or the rest of all of the teachers' times on Romans chapter 1. But it appears to me that these are clear indications that God is saying that at times I give them over. Reminds me of the two times in the Bible, Corinthians chapter 5 and then in the book of Timothy, I believe it is, where God turned people over to Satan. That sounds like a terrible thing. And I guess that, yes, it is a terrible thing. He did that in order to, I think, try to bring them back. And at least in some instances, it did bring people back. But there is a time when that seems to be the case that God does. Now there is a progression here that I think applies and is somewhat significant for us. What we see here in Romans chapter 1, I'm going to go back to verse 24 and go down through 28. I'll read all of those verses. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their hearts. The first mention, or the first phrase, God gave them up, has to do with sexual impurity and immorality. When a people, when a nation becomes so decadent sexually, I think this is teaching us that there is a moment or a time or an inevitability where God just says, okay, you want it? There it is. Go wallow in it. But in this chapter, we also have, I think, a second step. And in verse 26 that I've already read for you, but I have to attach that to verse 25. So verse 25, who changed the truth of God into a lie and worship and serve the Creator more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this cause, God gave them up unto vile affections, for even their women did change their natural use, that which is against nature, and likewise also the men leaving their natural nature. I think we've studied that. You know what he's talking about. He's talking about homosexuality and lesbianism. And it appears to me that this is set here a little bit aside because that is an even more decadent step for a culture and for a nation. Sexual immorality, idolatry is bad, and all sin in terms of its results and consequences, if it is not repented of, is equal. But it appears that God is placing this particular sin in a not an elevated, a de-elevated, whatever that is, position of great seriousness. When a nation, when a people spirals out of control to the extent they even go to this extreme decadence, I don't know what else to call it, it seems to be a further notch against them. I don't know what to make of this. I do find it interesting, so I'll share it with you, and you can agree with me or take your own take. It's interesting when he talks about this decadent behavior of homosexuality and lesbianism, he mentions the women first. Well, he's got to mention somebody first, so maybe that's just a flip of the coin. But I wonder if women are a little less inclined toward this toward decadence than men. And so he's got a case here where even you women started doing this. Now, I'm speculating and giving you my opinion, but it seems to me like there may be some significance there a little bit in the order. Not that it is worse for women to do this, it's just less natural for women to do this. And I don't even like what I just said because it's so unnatural for a man to do it. It's just a decadent, but we'll talk a little bit more next week when we talk about the family and Satan's attack on the family about this particular thing and how we can deal with it. I'd like to also go back to verse 18, which I have not read in chapter 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Now, what's the truth? The truth is the Word of God. These people were holding the truth as if it was not righteous and it was not the Word of God. So we've now got a society here described that is not familiar, is not recognizing, that's the word I wanted, is not recognizing the truth that God has revealed to them. And it leads to sexual frivolity, and then it leads to this ultimate decadence. Well, again, I don't want to be pessimistic, but I think we've got a pretty good description of what we see going on around us. And the reason we see all of these sins is because the truth is not held in reverence that it ought to be. John talked a little bit about the word last night. I don't know that he made this particular point, But it was underlying, I think, most, if not all, of what he said. Not holding it in reverence. And that's what happens. You take the Word of God out of the place of supremacy, you suppress the truth. You deny that it's true. You deny its veracity. Now, how does Satan do this? Well, I think there are multiple ways. I don't think I know all of the ways. First of all, he can teach us to be pluralistic, that there are no absolute truths. And if you believe there are no absolute truths, then there are no truths at all. But again, that's an argument, as we have said, that falls upon itself, because if there are no absolute truths, the truth that there are no absolute truths cannot be true. So you really, it just crumbles. But I think that's one of the ways Satan has attacked our society. People don't believe the Bible anymore. I don't believe people fear God. And we'll spend a little more time next week on this if time allows. Even in the church, I think we have been morphine-dized, and I know that's not a word, but put to slumber by thinking that fearing the God is simply having awe and reverence. There's a Greek word for that. It's called hogwash. Fearing God includes awe and reverence. But I think fearing God includes much more than just awe and reverence. After Ananias and Sapphira had sinned, it says, I think it's in verse 10 of that chapter in Acts, and the saints assembled with fear, or in the fear of the God. I don't think we're afraid of God. Now, I know the argument, well, we shouldn't tremble. God loves us, etc., etc., etc. Perfect love casts out fear. And if we have time, I'll tell you what I think that means. We've got time, so let me tell you what I think that means. I think perfect love does cast out fear. Now, raise your hand if you have perfect love. I think perfect love casts out fear. I'm just not personally persuaded that any of us achieve perfect love this side of Jordan. We achieve greater love, which lessens our fear, but Proverbs tells us, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. I don't personally want to have all of my fear of God cast out, because I find it to be one of the great restraining things in my life, and my life needs a lot of restraint. I fear what God will do to me if I do not do what He asks me to do. I do. And I hope I never quit that. But maybe we'll spend a little more time, or I'll give you a chance to share your thoughts on that. But hasn't the religious world cast out fear of God? It has. And I don't think that's necessarily to our detriment. I was reading an article a couple of weeks ago kind of on this, and I liked the title. It said, "We are trying to air condition hell." You can't air condition hell. Hell is hell. And we need to understand that. Okay. I'll try not to soapbox too much today. It was interesting. Yesterday, I will admit, I did get on my soapbox a little. Several people came up and said, "Are you okay?" Yeah, I was fine. But I was passionate. And I don't apologize for what I said. I might have to apologize a little bit for my vigor, but that was yesterday and today is today. So we will move on. There is a progression here that I see in Romans chapter 1, however, that I think is very important. Not only to the progression of decadence, we are told that we have been given the truth. That's the revelation. We are told, however, that even in His creation, we see the attributes of God. Therefore, no one is immune or let off the hook for not believing there is a God. In verse 22, I think there's another progression. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God. That is simply arrogance. Knowing God and then not glorifying Him as God. That's arrogance. And it led to idolatry, foolishness of their heart. And then finally, we see a little bit later, this led to, in verse 23, and they changed the glory of an incorruptible God into the image that was made. So we've got this transition from having been given the truth, not even really recognizing it within creation, and then arrogantly accepting the truth, but then not glorifying God, and then it leads to idolatry. So there's several progressions going on here in this first chapter of Romans that I think are lessons for us. I don't know exactly where we as a nation are on this progression. It varies, because it varies with people. Some are still holding the truth high, and I hope that's the majority, if not everybody here. Some of them, some aren't. Some ridicule it. I was telling somebody, I think it was last night, I was talking to somebody about, or yesterday, about their experience in universities. I was not a liberal arts major, and I thank God for that. It probably would have helped what I'm doing now more, but I had a double major. My undergraduate double major was biochemistry and microbiology, so you know I was a little geekish. But I had to take a couple of religion courses because you have to get a well-rounded education, which is another way of saying we need to have classes for these professors that are useless, so you have to take their courses. So I took my religion course in the summer. In fact, at Indiana University where I went, you could take, they had three sessions, a two-week session, a six-week session, and a two-week session. On the two-week session, you could get 6 hours of credit in 2 weeks by going 7 hours a day or something. So I took it then to get it over with. But my professor in religion, and I did get some good things out of it, he was not a Christian, and when we got, he kept talking about, you know, the Nicolaitans in Revelations, he always called them the Nickelodeons. And then he would laugh. And I say that, I guess it stuck with me. I guess I say that just to warn the young people, as you go into these things, you're not going to find very many Christian professors. You may find some that are kind, and they won't all just mock, but you won't find very many Christian professors. And you need to be very, very attuned and very grounded. And that gets back to what I said yesterday about some of us older need to help teach so that we are understand. Don't send your kids off to college and assume that it's going to be this wonderful learning experience. It'll be a learning experience. It may not be wonderful. I'm for you going. Just be careful. And have your feet planted as solidly as you can. I just can't leave this without at least giving you a chance to make two or three comments if you have them. If not, we're just going to go ahead, and I will limit it. Okay, we've trained you well. There is an obvious activity going on in our nation, probably in the world, to silence God. Small town after small town that used to have short prayers before their civic meetings are getting tired of being harassed by atheists. The grade school where my wife teaches in a rather conservative Midwest school district no longer has certain celebrations. And I'm not advocating in favor of these. It's just a trend. They no longer put up a Christmas tree in the hallway. They no longer have Halloween because people have objected. Not because of the reason some of you would object. They object because it's a reference in their minds to God. Well, I don't care whether they do or don't. It's just this idea of let's object to any reference of God or something that is holy. That is troubling for me. The staffers for the governor of Michigan removed the phrase "in the year of the Lord" from all state papers. So if you live in Michigan and get a paper or a letter from the state, it will not have the phrase "in the year of the Lord." District judge said that "so help me God" should be removed from the oath. Three plaques at the Grand Canyon with scriptures engraved upon them have been removed at the insistence of the ACLU. Now, can I live with all that? Yeah, I could live with it, but it is a sad trend of taking God out of our lives and out of our existence. Sociologists are increasingly referring to America as a post-Christian nation. And I think for valid cause. If you want to think of America as a Christian nation, go ahead. I don't have any evidence to support that. Well, there are Christians in America, but that's different than America being a Christian nation, it would seem to me. I believe Satan is turning his story or history into my story. And what I mean by that is, it's about us. Everything's about us. It's not about God. It's not even about others. And when you turn a society into a society about us or about them, then you have a very selfish, myopic society. I want to talk a little bit about separation of church and state. This is a phrase that is often heard and often used, and I have mixed feelings about it. But not maybe as mixed as you might think. Can anybody tell me, we've probably got some history, I know we've got history buffs, we may even have some history teachers. What amendment to the Constitution talks about separation of church and state? Does anybody remember? None. That's the right answer. It's not in the Constitution. It is not in the Constitution. In the Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther articulated a doctrine, and it wasn't just new to him, but the timing of it for the establishment of our nation seemed to have been somewhat significant. And it's called Luther's Doctrine of Two Kingdoms. And it really could go back to what I talked about a little bit earlier about the sacred and the secular societies and cultures. And I think we would all agree with that concept. Back in England in the 1500s, Henry VIII was angered by the Catholic Church's refusal to annul his marriage to Catherine and decided to break from the church, and that led to the setting up of the Church of England and had some impact on the translations that some of us use or in various forms today, the King James that came along somewhat later. But one of the results of that, as we know our American history, is that some people fled England and Europe looking for religious freedom, and they came here. Now, I am not a historian like some of you, but it's just fascinating as I read about that, is yes, there was some freedom here in America, but it wasn't long before those seeking freedom were trying to impose what they believed on other people, so the freedom seekers became maybe not the freedom practicers in the greatest sense of the word. But it was quite a noble endeavor. But the Reformation had a lot to do with it. There was also an era in history called the Enlightenment, sometimes called the Age of Reason. And this really began to have a mental, philosophical evolvement that has led to a lot of the things I believe we've talked about in my previous three sessions so far with you. It set up a real dichotomy, beginning at least or enhanced by the Enlightenment. The separation of the public and the private as it relates to philosophies. The public realm was a world that was ruled by reason, and reason became one of the kings of the Enlightenment. Leslie Niebuhr explained, as she wrote about this, the thinkers of the Enlightenment spoke of their age as the age of reason by which human beings could attain to a complete understanding of and thus a full mastery of nature in reality in all its forms through reason. Well, what effect did that have upon the spiritual? Well, if you believe that you can ascertain those answers through reason, and that is human reason, you have largely eliminated the need for the divine. The concept of separation of church and state, which we hear quite a bit about, has really been turned, I think, totally 180 degrees from what it was intended. It comes from a letter written by Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Church. The Danbury Church petitioned Thomas Jefferson, fearing that government would come in and impose or interfere with their religion, because that's what they had seen in Europe. That's why many of them came to America. So Thomas Jefferson, writing back to the congregation in Danbury wrote, and just a part of this I will read for you. I contemplate with solemn reverence that the act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a wall of separation between church and state. And that phrase, wall of separation, that Jefferson used in his letter to the Danbury Baptist Church, is what then led to the phrase separation of church and state. Now, you can find a few principles, maybe in the Bill of Rights, that you could make to this. But the point is, when Jefferson wrote this, he was assuring this congregation at Danbury that the government, at least as best he could handle, would not interfere with their worship. In other words, this phrase was originally intended to keep government out of religion. Today, because of judicial activism, it is used to keep religion out of the public domain. And that was never what it was intended for. It was intended to keep the government out of religion. It has been, through various judicial rulings and some legislation, largely now adopted to keep religion out of the public domain, which is not what Jefferson or our founding fathers had in mind. Now, I'm going to express an opinion here, and so you know what you can do with that. Don't even have to listen to it. I am a little ambivalent about the concept of keeping religion out of the public domain. And the reason I'm a little bit ambivalent, I tend to be for it if it's my religion, and I tend to be afraid of it if it's somebody else's religion, and that is, pardon me, white man speaking with forked tongue. So if I had to choose between keeping all religion out of public domain versus having false religion extolled in the public domain, I might vote to keep all of it out. But that is my opinion. But having said that, I think people's right to exercise their religion in a way that does not infringe or impugn upon others is a healthy part of freedom. But we often sometimes bemoan the fact that, boy, wouldn't it be good if we had prayer in school, maybe. Wouldn't it be good if our teachers could teach some theology and religion in school, maybe. But it would depend upon whether you agreed with that theology or not, and I'm pretty sure you wouldn't agree with much of it. So maybe a safer course is us for to be a little more cautious about that. Now, that's my opinion, and I respect your right to be wrong. So, you just go ahead and consider it. That obviously was tongue-in-cheek. There are several phrases, and I don't want to get into a civics class here, and I'm not qualified to teach a civics class without a lot of review. I think it's in the First Amendment, there's what's called the Establishment Clause, and you're familiar with this phrase, I imagine. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And that means government shouldn't establish or give preference to one religion over another. I personally have no trouble with that. I don't want my government to give preference because they will probably give preference to one that is not right. I don't have that much confidence in our government as it relates to that now. And as I said, it was originally intended to keep government out of religion, not to keep religion out of the public domain. I'm going to go over these slides very quickly because they're not as crucial as some of the others, but since they're here, rather than you wondering what's on them, I'll go over them rather quickly. Our Supreme Court has probably at least applied three tests to what is appropriate in terms of religion and government. The first one is called the Lemon Test, and it was affirmed in 1971. And it proposes that a law, in order to be, let me move on. Oops, didn't have it in there, so I got to move back. It's a good time to remember forgiveness. The Lemon Test, the Supreme Court in 1971 said a law must have no secular purpose, it must be neutral toward religions, and it must not result in excessive entanglements between government and religion. In principle, those sound good to me. So I like that one. There is the endorsement test. This was by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, that the law is unconstitutional if it favors one religion over another in any way that makes people feel like outsiders and others feel like insiders. I like that one because I don't think our government should be deciding religion and what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. I think we should be deciding that based upon the Word of God. And then there is what's called the coercion test. This was a test that Justice Kennedy most recently proposed, that a law is constitutional even if it recognizes or accommodates a religion, as long as it, as its demonstration of support does not appear to coerce individuals into supporting. In other words, he's saying a law could be beneficial to a religion as long as it doesn't make other people feel like they have to be part of that religion. There is a concept called the Free Exercise Clause in the First Amendment, and it reads as follows. Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise thereof, talking about the free exercise of religion. Congress shall make no law regarding the free exercise of religion. But there are exceptions to that, and you're probably familiar with a couple of them. One exception to that that has been court-tested is parents cannot deny their children badly needed medical attention and rely solely on prayer. And we see this sometimes in the Christian Scientist domain. There are cases where the government has stepped in so the children get appropriate medical care even though their parents claim that it violates their religion. If you've seen Amish with the little triangle reflector on the back that keeps us from running into their buggies, they were quite opposed to that because that was a symbol that they don't go for. But the government overruled that and said that the Amish can be compelled to wear slow vehicle reflectors on the backs of their buggies for the safety of them and for the public. Another exception to this, and it probably doesn't affect any in our brotherhood, but it could, it says that a congregation cannot generate annoyingly excessive noise during a service. I had to smile when I read that. I've been at a lot of service where there was annoyingly excessive noise, but that's not what they meant. They mean we can't blare it out to the point that it keeps everybody on the block awake. And that's kind of like you can't yell fire in a crowded place. I'm just going to comment on this man, and I can't pronounce his first name. I keep wanting to say governor, but it's not. It's what it is. This is a gentleman that lived in 1752 to 1816. He's not very well known, but he was one of the participants of the signing the Articles of Confederation. He was a member of the Continental Congress from 1778 to 1779. He died in 1816. 2 months before he died, September 4th, right around Labor Day, he gave a speech at a New York Historical Society. And I just wanted to note a few of the things that this man, one of our founding fathers, not our most name-worthy, felt very strongly about. In this speech, he reaffirmed his insistence that the Bible was key to making sense of history and from learning from it. He also felt that there was a profound lesson of political wisdom to be learned from 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel 8 is where the people are asking for a king, and Samuel gives them warnings of what's going to happen if they give a king, and God finally says, okay, you want one? You got one. And you know the history. And he took from that the importance of virtue as one of the principles of a republic. He felt that the Bible should be the basis for our national morality. He thought more than simply the Constitution was needed, and what he felt was needed for a country to exist successfully was religion. And I think we would all agree with that. Now, I don't know what his religion was, and I might not agree with his religion, but the concept was valid. And we have come a long way from that moment, haven't we? One of Satan's wiles that I had in your notes, so I'll just touch on it briefly, is I believe one of his wiles, one of his methodologies today, is what would be called the sanitization of sin. And what I mean by, or what is meant by the sanitization of sin, is that sin is no longer, it is rendered non-offensive. Sin is non-offensive. How many sins do you know today that are really offensive to the public? I can only think of two or three. Two or three. Maybe a few shades of others. Adultery is not offensive. Divorce isn't offensive. Pornography is not offensive to the public. You go down the list of things that might have made you blush when you were growing up, if you're anyways over 40, and those things really don't make you blush. For most people, abuse of children, homosexuality, lesbianism, a wife beating, those still are offensive to most people. But I don't know for how much longer. If history repeats itself, they will not be offensive very much longer. And a lot of it has to do with the change of language. Remember, I mentioned the other day, and I think others have mentioned, deviant sexual behavior is no longer a moral issue, it's a discrimination issue. And you and I are put in the place of, well, if you're against that, you're a bigot. You discriminate. Well, I guess I'm a bigot and discriminate against sin, and I want to always be in that category. You know, language change is just a fascinating thing. And don't take this as a political statement. But one of our political parties discovered that being a liberal was not a positive thing when people voted. So now what are they? They're progressives. Who doesn't want to be progressive? And again, that is not a political statement because the other side's done similar things too. But you just notice these subtle language changes as it relates to various activity. The concept of removing the consequences. There are no victims. Everybody's a victim. That's the way I want to say it. Very few have consequences for their actions. I want to start this one, even though I'm pretty sure I won't get all that far with it. And I want to give credit, this is not exclusively to his thinking, but some of you are familiar with a man by the name of Josh McDowell. And he came out several years ago. I Googled him last night to see how old he was. He's old now, but I'm not going to tell you how old he is because then I would have just called some of you old. But he's starting to show his age. Last time I watched him, he wasn't as sharp as he used to be, but I'll give him some credit for some of his original bringing these things to the fore in the 60s. But in one that I watched recently, he called America is in what he called a perfect storm. And what he was really talking about was an epistemological shift, an intellectual storm. Now, epistemology is simply the study of the nature and source of truth. And what he's saying is we're having a tremendous shift in the way we do or don't perceive truth. Well, I agree. And some of the points that I thought were significant, and I jotted them down as I was listening to him, man once believed that truth resided in God and man was responsible for responding to it. Now that is, I hope, what you and I still believe. Truth resides in God, and we are responsible for responding to it. The gospel call, whatever you want to call it. But then onto the scene came several movements that have turned that completely around. And very briefly, one of those movements was what was called the Renaissance. And you probably at least remember that term from history. If you're not in history class right now or a history teacher, you don't remember what that was. But the Renaissance essentially lowered God and elevated man. It was a concept, we don't need God, see how great man is. It didn't do away with God, but it began to take God from up here and man from down here to kind of one of these. Then there was the Enlightenment that elevated man further and said, see how great man is, and it attributed man's greatness to reason. That's why it was called the Age of Reason to some extent. And then there was the Industrial Revolution that some of us live through, maybe the tail end of it if we're not still in it, but we're probably in a technical revolution now, that elevated man even further because see how great man can produce. And it's no coincidence that modernism and then ultimately postmodernism really grew their feet in this Industrial Revolution, because the Industrial Revolution was when we were going to the moon. If you were alive, if you were 10 years or older in 1969, you probably know exactly where you were when Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon. I know exactly where I was. I wasn't in front of a TV, I was frying donuts at a bakery. But I remember exactly where I was, just like I remember exactly where I was when JFK was killed. I was in 8th grade Miss Marshall's history class, or English class. But we were so focused on technology that that became our keying. We can solve everything, and so we don't need God. And that's probably what led to postmodernism, which said, nope, we're not solving everything, so there must not be any answers, and that led to pluralistic postmodernism. But none of those answered the two key questions: what is the origin of man, and what is the origin of the universe? Therefore, we had a scientific worldview that tried to answer those questions: what's the origin of man, and what's the origin of the universe? And it led to an enhanced attachment to Darwinianism, and then added to enhanced attachment to evolution. I'm going to end on this next slide, but before I show it, if it's the one I think it is, remember, I was a science major, so I'm poking fun at myself. But scientists and science teachers are an odd lot. They're not a bad lot always, but they're an odd lot. But you never want them to babysit for you. It takes a little while to sink in. You have 15 minutes.